Part 8. Some of our best friends were drug dealers. Chapter 1. Doc McGee. In which a primary caretaker of Motley Crue discusses the finer points of full contact management. My biggest regret as a manager is that I let Vince think he could get away with murder. I remember sitting with Vince after the accident with Razzle, and the lawyers said to him, "The judge wants you to do some time." Vince looked up at them and, I'll never forget these words, said, "I can't." "What do you mean you can't?" I asked him. "I have to go on tour." "Oh, fuck," I slapped my head. "Why didn't I think of using that as your defense? My client, Vince Neil, is innocent of manslaughter and cannot serve time because he has to play some concerts. Case closed." In Vince's mind, he thought he was above the law, and walking away from that disaster with a few weeks in a luxury jail and a $12,000 Rolex certainly didn't teach him otherwise. Now he had every excuse in the world to do what he wanted because nothing could stop him. Guys like Mick, who never said more than 7 words to me in my first 5 years with the band, had eaten shit for so long that they knew what it was like to be nothing. Of course, Mick was a pretty depressed guy after all that, and such a pushover that I always thought he should have his own television show. Do you want to take advantage of me? My real nightmare managing the band began when I tried to keep Vince sober while he was on probation. In Orlando, Florida, on the Theater of Pain tour, we were so sick of his antics that we left him in a hotel room with 2 bodyguards and told them to just beat the shit out of him. The guy's biggest enemy was always himself. On the girls' tour, he was making a sandwich backstage in Rochester and threw a fit when all they had was a jar of Goulden's mustard, not French's mustard. So he slammed the glass bottle against the wall and severed the tendons in several fingers on his right hand. We had to cancel the show and airlift him to a hand specialist in Baltimore. Of course, Vince can't entirely be blamed for his behavior. As his managers, Doug and I condoned it to a certain extent by allowing it to continue, perhaps because the band was so popular. But finally, we had to put our foot down. And what shocked us most is that it wasn't because of Vince. It was because of Nicky. Now, Nicky, the king of the losers, had begun to unravel on the girls' tour. Neither Doug nor I wanted to be around him, so we drew straws to see who would accompany the band to Japan. I drew the short one. Mr. Udo, the promoter there, is one of my best friends. Every time he takes a band to Japan, he puts his reputation on the line for them. And it was no different from Motley Crue, except that Motley Crue couldn't give a fuck. They are savages with cash who care nothing about nobody, even each other. The first thing that happened when we arrived in Japan was that Tommy got caught with pot in his drum kit. Mr. Udo bailed us out of that, and a few days later, we were all leaving Osaka on the bullet train after a show. These clowns were in full costume, with makeup running down their faces and chains and tattoos everywhere. Nicky and Tommy went completely out of control. If you flew above the train in a helicopter, you would have seen all these Japanese people scurrying like cockroaches out of the car we were in. If you zoomed in, you would have seen Nicky throwing a bottle of Jack Daniels and hitting a Japanese businessman in the back of the skull. Lower the microphone, and you would have heard the guy screaming and the blood pumping out of his head. It was just brutal shit. Brutal. When we pulled into the Tokyo station, there were hundreds of policemen running alongside the car. "Hey, Nicky," I said, "your fan club's here." And he was so whacked out that he didn't realize they'd sent the riot squad after him. He thought it was an adoring Japanese public. They hauled Nicky and me to jail. And as we were sitting there, he said to me, "So, dude, how do you like these tattoos? What do you think the cops will think of them?" I thought about my life in Miami. I had a pretty good business going before I moved to the West Coast to manage these guys. I'd played guitar, produced albums by Styx, the Ohio Players, and the Average White Band, managed nice guys like Pat Travers. Life was so peaceful and easy back then. "I don't know," I replied to Nicky, "but I'll tell you this. If they let me get my hands free, I'm going to beat the living shit out of you." Finally, despite Nicky smarting off the whole time, he was released at 5 a.m. I stayed in the station taking care of paperwork all day, and when I finally returned to my hotel room that night, ready to collapse, Who should come banging on the door but Vince? He was smashed and trying to fuck the girlfriend of some Yakuza gangster. But at the same time, his brain-dead LA girlfriend had just arrived in Japan and was in his room. So he's pissed off because he doesn't want to deal with the latest mess his dick has gotten him into. Fire the travel agent, he slobbers. What? Fire the fucking travel agent. I had taken all I could take that day. I smashed him in the face, closed the door, and sank into a peaceful sleep. That's how it was with those guys. We would punch the shit out of each other all the time. I called it full contact management. When, a few days later, Nicky said he was traveling to Hong Kong, Thailand, and Malaysia with nothing but a pack of rubbers, I considered further violence. I knew I'd have to tag along and babysit, because if I didn't, he'd wind up dead or lost or sold into white slavery. Fortunately, he didn't make it any further than Hong Kong, where he ordered something like 150 prostitutes in 2 days. I could have killed him when he sent a dozen giggling prostitutes to my door while I was on the phone with my family. Of course, Nicky wasn't sexually active then. He probably just talked and talked and talked to the poor hookers until they came to the conclusion that no amount of money was worth this torture. He was a stone-cold junkie, and he was pretty bad off. When we returned to California in December, I started getting calls in the middle of the night from the security company that protected his house because they'd answer alarms only to find him slithering around his yard with a shotgun. A few days before Christmas, I went to dinner with Bob Krasnow of Elektra. So, he said, how are the guys doing? They'll be okay, I said, if they can stay alive. Then, just after dinner, Doug called. Nicky had overdosed in some hotel room, and they thought he was dead. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was. After shock came disgust, then came disappointment. I was upset with myself for being involved with a band like this and for, in some way, allowing these guys to get away with behaving like animals, especially now that one animal had killed himself. When I found out that Nicky was actually alive and had escaped from the hospital, I knew what I had to do. I went into the office, called Doug to my desk, and told him, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to watch people die. They had a European tour scheduled, and there was a better chance of them coming home in body bags than on the Concorde. We canceled the tour and went in search of Nicky. No one answered his phone, but he had changed his answering machine message, so we knew he had been there. We drove to his house and found him knocked out in his bathroom with blood all over the walls. He was lying there in leather pants and no shirt, smacked out and incoherent. I talked him into coming to my house to detox. The problem with Nicky is that, as far as he's concerned, nothing controls him. He controls everything. But in this case, heroin was a much bigger power than he was prepared to reckon with. Nicky stayed at my place in Tarzana for almost a week. Bob Timmons came over every day to try to keep him sober, and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, who had taken an interest in Nicky, called every day to bully him into straightening up. You're going to die, he'd tell him. You've got to see it. Finally, Nicky broke down. He admitted to us for the first time that he couldn't control his addiction. We called in the rest of the band and held a big meeting in my living room. They looked pathetic. There was Nicky, who was dying, Tommy, who was getting loaded and fighting with his wife, Vince, who was completely out of control, and Mick, who basically woke up every morning and drank and sobbed to himself until he passed out. And this was supposed to be one of the biggest, greatest rock bands in the world. Doug and I told them, first, that they were going to pay back the promoters in Europe for their canceled tour out of their own pockets. Second, they were either going to straighten up or find new management. We presented a united front. Nicky admitted that he needed to check into a hospital, something he had never agreed to before. Tommy, who so easily led he'd drink Kool-Aid if Jim Jones asked him to, said he was in, of course. Vince, stubborn and in denial, dragged his heels and waffled, and Mick just gave us a funny look.